Welcome to the Katakalam Project on Katakalam Media. This is Che Ting Ye. What do you think when we mention Taiwanese food? Bubble tea and stinky tofu, for sure. If you're a connoisseur, you would also think of gua bao, the original pork bun sandwich with pickled mustard greens and a sweet peanut powder. If you're even more advanced, you might even explain that Taiwan itself is made up of layers of colonial and seafaring histories, and its food is a chaotic mix of everything that was left behind. But you might not know that Taiwan has had pop-up restaurants for 100 or even 200 years. But more on that later. Today, as with many things in Taiwan, there is sort of an identity crisis coupled with uncertainty for the future. We watch chefs with focused and unconventional minds like Ferran Adria and René Redzepi take their native cooking histories of Catalan and Denmark and transform them in a way that puts them at the forefront of gastronomy. We watch with envy as Taiwan's neighbors like Korea, Vietnam, not to mention Japan, promote their rich food cultures as part of their international soft power. We watch Taiwan struggle to build a homegrown fine dining and farming culture, while talented chefs seek opportunities elsewhere. Is Taiwanese food limited to bubble tea and stinky tofu? What are the possibilities? To answer these questions, we asked Liz Cao, who watches the food world internationally, but also thinks very deeply about the food culture in Taiwan. She is the author of the popular food trends blog, The Self-Taught Gourmet, and her simple Japanese home recipes were published as a cookbook called My Japanese Pantry. She also writes for Taiwan's lifestyle magazine Bios Monthly, as well as the upcoming Taiwan edition of Lucky Peach. She has also recently started Sauce Elizabeth, a chili sauce that pretty much goes on, well, everything. So we caught up with her, and here is our interview. So Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Hi, everyone.
Tell us a little bit about your own story. Many people are curious. I mean, you were an NTU graduate in law, right?
Hi.
And then you went to the NTU of the United States, Harvard, for law again.
Yes.
People are probably curious why you left that very elite law education and law career to work on a food related, you know, thing, to, you know, write a food blog and then eventually with your own line of products, your hot sauce. So how did all that come about?
After graduating from NTU, I worked at an international law firm in Taipei. And then I went to Harvard. And after Harvard, I went back to the same firm. And it was at that time that I felt I didn't have the passion for legal practice, this legal career, like climbing up the law firm ladder. So I just felt indifferent of the legal issues in my everyday job. And I just didn't care. And at that time, food writing kicked in. It was about the same time that a bunch of my friends started a website called Bios Monthly in Taiwan, and they were recruiting food columnists. And so I volunteered, and I said, okay, I want to write about food, and I want to write about Japanese food. That was how it started. And after a while, I got really interested in it, and it had a great sense of accomplishment. So I started my own food blog. And luckily, a publisher noticed my work and offered me a book deal. After some struggling and fighting with my dad, I decided to quit my big law job and focus on the book. Yeah. Uh-huh. So the book came out, and it got some nice reviews. And it got me the attention I needed. And then I started to think about doing something else. In my book, I introduced a Japanese hot sauce. It was called Tabelulayu. It's mm-hmm. like edible hot sauce.
Right. Uh-huh.
Right. So I made some of them, some of the sauces to give it to my friends and family members, and they all loved it. So I thought maybe I could sell it. So that was how I started my sauce business. Yeah.
Wow. It sounds very easy when you were talking about it just now, but I'm sure along the way there were many difficulties and definitely probably times where you're thinking, you know, okay, maybe that was a mistake. Maybe I should not have left the law firm. I mean, just coming from the same background, yeah. I also left the law firm to, I guess, run a blog. So how was that process? You know, what are some of the difficulties with that, you know, during that whole process?
I think at first it was trying to persuade my families.
Right.
Yeah. Because when I told my dad that I wanted to write about food, I wanted to become a food writer, he was really angry. And you could imagine that because he paid a lot of attention to my education.
Right.
I can also understand that. Yeah. But,
I see. Uh-huh.
Yeah. But I just, I tried to prove to him that this is what I want. And mm-hmm. so I blog. I go to work in the day and I blog at night. And also I started a Facebook fan page. And mm-hmm. Some of his friends would follow me on Facebook and tell him that, oh, your daughter is doing that, you're this, and she's doing great. And so my dad started to realize what I was doing. Yeah.
Oh, wow. So, okay.
Yeah.
So, Mom, if you're listening to this podcast right now, so let's move away from that a little bit. And obviously, I've been a big fan of your Facebook page and your blog since it came
Thank
out.
Thank you so much.
And because, you know, I love to eat too, as many people know. You write a lot, not just about food. You know, in terms of, you know, because most people on the blog, they say it's mostly, okay, I go to this restaurant, I take pictures, I write about what I ate, right? But you also have, in your blog, you also have writings about your opinions or your thoughts about food, the food world, or about cooking, especially about fine dining, fine dining in Taiwan. So just to start, how would you define fine dining, or what is fine dining to you?
Of course, I think it is a great pleasure in its own right. When you enjoy fine dining, you know, it's really an intricate experience. But then I think there is so much knowledge to it. When you learn more about it, about the chef, your philosophy, your business models, you will understand that fine dining is the driving force of the culinary industry.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see in the past 20 years, almost all of the pioneering culinary trends happened in fine dining first, and then trickled down to the more approachable markets.
Sure.
Yeah. So, for example, molecular gastronomy is a good example.
Mm-hmm.
At first, it was associated with Varane Adria or Heston Blumenthal, although the two chefs, they disapproved this term and prefer to be called avant-garde or techno-emotional, whatever. Okay, but now, molecular gastronomy can be seen at many more casual establishments, and the cooking techniques as well, such as sous vide or spherification, they are getting more and more common and approachable.
Mm-hmm.
So, also, you can see the influences of a fine dining celebrity chef. Their influence is just so far-reaching. So, I think it's fine dining actually is really how you understand the real dining world.
I see. So, would you say, when we talk about fine dining, we're thinking about, for example, restaurants are pretty expensive, right? And I don't know if that's the primary way we can differentiate between fine dining and regular food.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, what do you think? How would you differentiate if somebody says, oh, this is a fine dining restaurant, or this is a fine dining establishment, versus no, I don't think that's fine dining?
I think there is a certain formality to it.
Sure,
like
uh-huh.
When you go to a French restaurant, you will know the more traditional French restaurant, you will know there is a like tasting menu.
Mm-hmm.
You can have the appetizers and the main course and the dessert.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the tableware they use and the services they provide and the price, of course. Usually mm-hmm. fine dining is pretty pricey, but mm-hmm. nowadays I think fine dining and casual dining, the lines are being blurred.
Right.
Sometimes now you go to a restaurant, it's the vibe is more casual and the services are more relaxing, but then the price is still pretty high and the food is still very high quality. So actually there is no clear definition. The more traditional restaurants, maybe they will have a more clearer definition, but then with the dining industry's development, more new restaurants, they have a different concept.
I see. I mean, I think, well, maybe, I don't know, to me, at least there is also should be an element of, for me, I guess fine dining should have an element of where the food, there's a craft to it, where there's sort mm-hmm. of a professionalism, where they say, okay, we're going to really make this food something like the best we can make it, and something very special.
Mm-hmm. Right. And a lot of times there is a philosophy uh-huh. in it. Yeah,
right,
fine dining. Right.
Yeah.
Right. So.
So let's talk a little bit about Taiwan and when people think of Taiwanese food, especially you know us Americans. Here, you know, people think, oh, it's like bubble tea, right? It's like stinky tofu, right? Uh-huh. Oyster pancakes and a sorts of, you know, other night market snacks. And that's pretty much it. I think when people think Taiwanese food, that's the thing that comes first. And probably nothing really else comes to mind. Do you think there's more to that, or, you know, in terms of what we think of Taiwanese food? Or and especially, do you think there's anything we can refer to as Taiwanese fine dining?
Of course, there's more to street foods, but why people think about Taiwanese food, like what you said just now, I think there mm-hmm. is a reason. Actually, there is no clear definition of Taiwanese food. Taiwan is a country with a relatively short history, and like many such countries, for example, the US, Australia, or Singapore, they are a melting pot. So mm-hmm. you can see a lot of different influences in Taiwanese food. Japan, for example, mm-hmm. people in Taiwan still very, very much love Japanese cuisine. And also you can taste different cuisines brought by the mainlanders, you know, mm-hmm. Beijing, Sichuan, Shanghai, and so on. I think it's better to explain Taiwanese food on a historic basis.
I see, uh-huh.
Yeah, here I'm dividing the history of Taiwan by the 17th century. Before the 17th century, there were the Aboriginal people. And after the 17th century, there were several times of colonial occupation. And first, Holland and Spain, and followed mm-hmm. by the kingdom of the Zheng family, Zheng Chenggong, mm-hmm. and the Qing dynasty, Japan, and KMT. Today, I'm not going to talk about the Aboriginal influences because, as a very sad matter of fact, the Aboriginal people were being oppressed and their culture were being sabotaged. So as to the their culinary influences, I think it was not that great in today's Taiwanese dining landscape. But I hope I will cover that in the future.
Right. Uh-huh.
Okay, so back to the history. It was after the 17th century that many of the Han people started to migrate from China to Taiwan. And mm-hmm. together with them, they have brought their eating habits and food cultures. And mm-hmm. In the early days, immigrants were mostly from southern Fujian, mm-hmm. Minnan, and Canton. And mm-hmm. there were also Hakka people. So today, when we say Taiwanese cuisine in a narrow sense, it's mostly a combination of Fujian and Hakka cooking.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot seafood-based, and the cooking style is light and fresh, mm-hmm. praising the original flavors of the ingredients. And we were just talking about street food. Taiwan is very well known for street food. It has something to do with the immigrant characteristics as well. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah. So the early immigrants, they built temples and held banquets in honor of the gods. Mm-hmm. And these gatherings, they usually take place under a large tree or in front of the temples, and naturally attracted vendors of food and other things. So for example, so for example, like in Keelung, the Miaokou market, case. Right. It was just next to Dianji Gong, the temple of Dianji. Right. Mm-hmm. And Tainan is another great example, such as Tianhou Gong or Wu Miao.
Right.
There were a lot of vendors beside these temples. So Taiwan food culture is a lot based in these kind of immigrant characteristics. But there are, of course, foods other than street foods, such as roadside banquet, bando. Banquets, I think it's a great way to experience Taiwanese food culture. Usually, when you have roadside banquets, it was for celebrations or some festivals, and a head chef, Zong Po Sai, will bring his crew and set up a kitchen and a dining area just beside the road or on a square. And while the setup of the place might be humble, the dishes served are usually very luxurious.
So like you can, So you're telling us basically that that pop-up restaurants basically have been in Taiwan for, you know, several hundred years.
Uh-huh.
Right? Cause...
Right. That was the idea, right? So you could say roadside banquets are the first generations of pop-up restaurants. Yeah. So in these banquets, you could see lobster, abalone, or even shark's fin. And the cooking style is still a mixture of Taiwanese, Chinese, Japanese influences. And you could see like some of the famous dishes like the sashimi boat or the steamed crab and sticky rice, Hong Xun Mi Gao, or Buddha Jumps Over the Wall, Fo Tiao Chang, which are all quite luxurious.
And how, I mean, this is just an assignment. How does one prepare that in a, you know, makeshift kitchen out on the street? It's called completely beyond me.
Amazing.
But I mean, that's definitely part of Taiwan's big part of Taiwan's food culture that I don't think a lot of people outside of Taiwan who did not grow up in that culture sort of readily think of, right?
Right.
And does that still happen a lot these days? I'm actually not sure, because I'm thinking, you know, there's so many, it's so much more densely populated now.
Right.
At least in the cities, do you still see bando, you know, roadside banquets? Do you still see them as often?
No, I don't think so. But I think there are more in the southern part of Taiwan.
Sure, uh-huh.
Yeah. But in where I live, Taipei, I think it's getting more and more, less and less popular.
Right. So I guess, I mean, I don't know if it would be fair to say that's a form of fine dining sort of in the past, right? For people back then, that was sort of, you know, the best food you could hope to eat, right? If somebody gets married or... you know, if there's a funeral or there's a big holiday celebration, you know, they have these roadside banquets. Nowadays, I don't know if it's fair to say that when people think of fine dining in Taiwan, they usually think of either European or Japanese food.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Is there anything that we can sort of consider fine dining that's specifically or that's more Taiwanese?
I think the current notion of fine dining is very much biased towards the European style or the Japanese style. Mm-hmm. So under that standard, I think there is actually no Taiwanese fine dining now.
I see.
But actually, you can see that like the European style fine dining or the Japanese style fine dining, the form itself is very intricate and very much formalized. And to have that kind of dining, it requires a long and stable period of time for people to develop that kind of taste. So I think given the short history of Taiwan and the immigrant characteristics I was talking just now, I think to that kind of fine dining in Taiwan is still lacking.
I see. Yeah. I don't know if this is correct to say, but a lot of these, at least in France or in Japan, the fine dining traditions, basically a lot of them came out of aristocrats and emperors who have nothing else better to do but to show off how much, you know, how long they can, you know, have a banquet for. I don't know. But So another question that people, especially I have a lot of Taiwanese American friends who are, you know, very proud to be from Taiwan, and then they go out and they're like, no one's ever heard of food from Taiwan or Taiwanese food, you know, like Japanese food, Korean food, even Indian food, Vietnamese food gets a lot of attention in the U.S. and even has you know, basically capture the imaginations, I would say, of mainstream American chefs.
Right.
So is that just a marketing problem or maybe is there something else? Why is that the case?
Yeah, of course it is a marketing problem, but also there are many other issues. I think first of all, the spreading of a food culture can usually be attributed to strong economic power. Japanese food began to spread in the 1970s, and when Japan had recovered from the wars and become a modern country, it was at that time that the Japanese success intrigued the world, and also at that time, the lavish Japanese food culture captured people's attention, and also, Japan increased overseas investment and tourism around that time as well, which resulted in a lot of Japanese expats and tourists, and thus creating an overseas market for Japanese food. So I think that was kind of the starting point for Japanese food to spread around the world today. And also, when we think of Korean food, I think South Korea is really doing a great job in the marketing.
Right.
You could see the former president Lee Myung-bak. He made the promotion of Korean food a very important task. They had this Korean Food Foundation. It was founded in 2010. It's an official government-registered institution, and its purpose is solely to promote and expand the Korean food. So you know the Koreans, they will make things happen with the support of the entire country. So they wanted to promote Korean food, and they wanted to make Korean food as one of the top five cuisines in the world by 2017.
Wow.
Right. And they have a high budget for it, $38 million.
Wow.
So what do they do? Yeah, what do? They produce the propaganda materials, they train culinary talents, they provide startup consulting and management, they do research and develop food-related subjects. So it's pretty much a comprehensive project. And so there's one simple example to explain the foundation's work progress. So I attended Asia's 50 Best Restaurants in Singapore just a couple of months ago.
Right.
And I got this media bag. And in the bag, there were many samples provided by the sponsors. But there were two things catching my eyes. A book titled Great Food, Great Stories from Korea, and a DVD called The Taste of Korea. Wow. Both produced by the same foundation. So, you know, it's as simple as that. No, they are doing everything to let people in the world know about Korean food.
Wow.
Right. Yeah. So you can see Taiwan does not enjoy the economic strength that Japan once had, or Taiwan doesn't do a very good job in marketing as Korea does. But I think most importantly, I think there's one more fundamental problem of Taiwanese food, that is branding. Because from what I said just now, Taiwanese food doesn't have a clear identity. We are just a melting pot. We just have too many cultures mixed together. And so we can't define ourselves very clear. What is Taiwanese cuisine? You know, if you are asked this question, it's hardly to give a straightforward answer.
That's right, Yang.
Yeah. So I think in order to promote ourselves in the world, we must first know ourselves and identify ourselves. And that was what I was discussing about with Chef Andre Jiang in Singapore back in February. Uh-huh. Yeah, I did an interview with him.
So that he's, was how he felt. He's originally from Taiwan, but then he's working in Singapore now.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
He's been working in France and other places for a long time. And now he's operating his restaurant in Singapore.
I see. And I mean, I guess the obvious question some people might have is, well, why don't you come back to Taiwan, right?
Right.
Yeah, and
I heard uh-huh. that he might be opening a restaurant in Taiwan, but definitely not Restaurant Andre, not that kind of fine dining restaurant.
Right.
But I just heard that he might be doing something in Taiwan. But
uh-huh.
yeah, but I think Taiwan is not a good place for him to have another fine dining restaurant.
Right, or not, you know, and not to mention moving his flagship from Singapore mm-hmm. to Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's interesting because, you know, for example, we think about Taiwanese food, you know, I mean, this is the next question is you know, people talk about Fran Adria and Rene Redzepi and mm-hmm. even Marcus Nielsen, right?
Mm-hmm,
about with Catalonian food or Catalan food, with Danish food, Swedish food, and a lot of these chefs, at least from what they say themselves, they go back to their own culinary traditions in mm-hmm. their regions or in their countries, and then they find elements about it that excite them or that that they want to do something with, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're, you know, sort of redefining their old national traditions.
Right.
And then kind of jumping them to the front of the culinary world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, before Rene, I don't think anybody would have wanted to go to Denmark to
right.
spend $300-$400 a meal, right?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And, you know, with Favi Ken, like people, I think you have to, I don't know, like drive up in the snow for like 3 hours just to go to this place. Do you see something like that happening in Taiwan eventually, or you know, is there anybody doing interesting things with food in Taiwan today? So how do you see how that future, you know, optimistically or pessimistically, how's that going to unfold?
I think I'm more optimistic.
Okay, good.
there is possibility. Of course now there are some chefs playing with local produce already. They use them in Western cooking. For example, Lan Shu Chen, mm-hmm. whose restaurant Le Mood just landed at number 24th in this year's Asia's 50 Best Restaurants,
mm-hmm.
and herself also won Asia's Best Female Chef this year.
Mm-hmm.
And Lan Shu pretty much likes to incorporate Taiwanese flavors into French hall cuisine. Like she uses green bamboo shoot, burdock. Mm-hmm. Or the restaurant pickles their own mustard cabbage, meigancai, salted cabbage, xuecai.
Interesting.
Yeah, uh-huh. They use these stuff. But still, I don't think this kind of cooking has reached culinary novelty as you mentioned, Ferran or Recipe, right? Uh-huh. Still, it's simply just using local ingredients in another type of cuisine. But mm-hmm. that being said, I still think the kind of culinary innovation is possible to take place in Taiwan. First mm-hmm. of all, Taiwan has advanced agriculture. That's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is that I know there are more and more young chefs aspire to do something different. And many of them, I know them personally, and they are now mm-hmm. working abroad at established fine dining restaurants. And mm-hmm. they are also very well aware of the global culinary trends and the celebrity chefs, all those kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
And just like Farhan Adria or Rene Recipe, they started their cooking career to cook French cooking or working at a French restaurant. I think that these Taiwanese young chefs, they might come back to Taiwan and bring something different from abroad to mm-hmm. stimulate the Taiwanese dining landscape, I think. Mm-hmm. And but then to really make it happen, I think it requires more than culinary techniques. You need mm-hmm. to have an understanding of a lot of different disciplines, such as you need to understand aesthetics, you need to know the terroir of where you live and the history of this country. Like, you need to be an artist and a philosopher at the same time. So yeah, I think basically, you know, you have to really know a lot of things.
Wow. And, yeah.
Yeah, not just cooking.
Right, right. Wow. No, I keep having this image in my mind of roadside banquet, Dong Po Sai pulling out a immersion circulator.
That would be kind of romantic, I think.
Right. lastly, so it was a personal point not to ask you about restaurant recommendations in Taiwan, because I know a lot of people might be interested in that, but that's not what this is about. But we do, you know, if anybody's interested, they could go check out your blog, right? It's at selftaughtgourmet.blogspot.com. And also, right. Would you like to talk a little bit more about the hot sauce that you are working on? And, you know, if any of us wants to try it or order it, how would we be able to do that?
Yes, thank you. So my sauce is called Sauce Elizabeth. In Chinese, it's 伊丽莎白辣酱. So you could check out our blog. The sauce has its own blog as well. It's you could Google. It's in Chinese. I'm sorry. It's you can Google 伊丽莎白生活酱料提案. The address is elizabethcow.blogspot.tw. You could check us out there, and also. Our sauces could be found at some select shops in Taipei, such as Xiao Qi or San Shi Xuan Wu and Cafe Junkies. So if you happen to come to Taipei, you could go check out the shops and perhaps you could bring a few of our sauces back home. Yep.
Wow. Well, thanks so much for telling us about the sauce and, you know, walking us through the past and the future of Taiwanese food and food in Taiwan. And you know, I think there is definitely reason for us to be optimistic about what's coming up next. So thanks so much again for your
time.
Thank
you.
This is Che Ting Ye, and you've been listening to The Katagalan Project on Katagalan Media. Find us on our website, katagalanmedia.com, where you will find commentary on current affairs, in-depth interviews on culture and history, and a weekly news update that keeps you more informed, better informed. That's KetagalanMedia.com. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Thanks for listening, and tune in next time.